You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I am Jen Zaman, and I am sitting in for Judy Ansel, who is out of town. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local Teamsters Joint Council 56 and United Steelworkers District 11. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our 9 local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank all of our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, one-man trains are not a dystopian nightmare. They're the near future. We'll talk to Bruce Campbell on his new book on a one-man train disaster, The Lac-Megantic Rail Disaster, Public Betrayal, Justice Denied. Then, find out about organized labor's new caucus in the Missouri Democratic Party. In the news, there's not much to celebrate on Equal Pay Day, and Google to require contractors to pay $15 an hour. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. She'll discuss the link between metal exposure and Parkinson's symptoms, the search for solutions to an invisible threat that affects cancer care workers, and large numbers of unreported mining-related injuries and illnesses in Illinois. And now for the news.
The news from our side, April 4, 2019. An internal memo from Google that was provided exclusively to The Hill says that Google will require its contractors and temporary workforce to receive full benefits, including comprehensive health, 12 weeks of paid parental leave, a minimum of 8 days of sick leave, and a $15 an hour minimum wage. The memo, quoting the VP of People Operations, says these requirements must be in place by 2022. The memo came out Tuesday, the same day that the group of 915 Google workers signed on to a letter demanding equal treatment for the company's temporary workers and contractors, known internally as TVCs. This letter claims that temporary workers and contractors account for 54% of Google's workforce, or 122,000 positions. For years, Google's employees have raised concerns that the company's workplace is stratified, with temporary workers and contractors receiving lower pay and fewer benefits than permanent employees. Companies have until January to start paying at least $15 an hour and until 2022 to get everyone health insurance. If the supplier fails to offer health care, minimum wage, and paid family leave to their employees by that deadline, a Google spokeswoman told The Hill that they would no longer be able to provide talent to Google. Another requirement benefit is $5,000 in tuition reimbursement for employees who hope to learn new skills or take courses. The benefits will not extend to independent contractors who are self-employed, but they will extend to vendors, employees that work for companies that are under contract with Google. Vendors include those who work for Google's cafes, transportation services, and more.
Tuesday was Equal Pay Day, which has been designated as the day on which women earn the equivalent of what men earned last year. If women were paid equally with men, that day would be December 31st. But alas, they're not, and have to work 3 months more just to make what an average man makes. So, with strong worker, labor, and women's group support, the Democratic-run U.S. House voted March 27th to strengthen the 56-year-old U.S. Equal Pay Act, giving women and minorities more tools to fight back when businesses discriminate and short their paychecks. PII reports that the bill passed 242-187, mostly along party lines. However, seven Republicans broke ranks and joined all 235 Democrats in voting for pay equity. The median weekly wage for a working woman is 77 to 80 cents for every dollar of the median wage for an equivalent working man, depending on the data analyzed. That ratio, persisting for decades, costs millions of women $900 billion yearly in lost pay and later lower Social Security benefits. The median is where half of all women are above and half below. The exception, median paid for unionized working women, is $968 weekly, 86% of the median for unionized working men. The legislation, H.R. 7, the Paycheck Fairness Act, was introduced by Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. H.R. 7 would hold employers accountability for discriminatory practices and the practice of pay secrecy, ease workers' ability to individually or jointly challenge pay discrimination in court, strengthen remedies for wronged employees, and prohibit employers from seeking the salary history of prospective employees. Bosses use past salary history and discrimination to perpetuate it. Representative Steny Hoyer says paycheck fairness and pay equity would add $900 billion yearly to women's pockets while cutting poverty in half. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoie, and I am Jen Zaman.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoie, and tonight our show is on the Loch Majestic disaster. Our guest is Bruce Campbell. Title of his book is The Loch Majestic Rail Disaster, Public Betrayal, and Justice Denied. Good evening, Bruce. Thank you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
It's great to be with you, Michael.
Indeed. Let me start out by saying, Bruce, how impressed I was with your investigative journalism. Certainly, it was clear in reading your book what a tremendous amount of work that went into telling the truth about this.
Well, thank you. It's been a long journey, the result of five years of research, and I'm glad it's finally out in a form that that people can get a sense of what happened, why it happened, and who is accountable.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, could you tell our listening audience a little about the events that led to this largest rail disaster in North American in recent North American history?
Yeah, I'll give you a sense of the days leading up to the tragedy. This was a train that left Newtown, North Dakota. It was carrying Bakken shale, 72 cars worth of very high volatile oil. Was misclassified as low volatility. It traveled through the U.S. down through Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago, up over to Detroit, and then into Canada, and ended up at Montreal. It was a CP train, and the CEO was a guy named Hunter Harrison, who railroaders listening to this show will know about Hunter Harrison. He's kind of the bane of the industry, depending on where you're standing. Certainly for workers, with his precision railroading, which was basically a cut strategy. In any case, it handed off the subcontracted and handed off the train to another train called Montreal, Maine and Atlantic, which was owned by a guy named Ed Burkhart. He was a Chicago-based railroader, sort of in the same mold as Hunter Harrison. It was picked up. He had, and this is an example of just regulatory negligence in the extreme. This was really a delinquent company, and it was given uniquely the permission to run its oil trains with a single operator, if you can imagine. The locomotive engineer left in the afternoon. Very soon after he left, he noticed there was real problems with the lead locomotive. It was surging and spitting oil, and it was very slow. That combined with the quality of the track meant it took 10 and a half hours to get to its destination for the night, which was a town about 5-6 miles from Lac Megantic, which is right beside the lake. It's a balmy summer night, middle of July. He had to park on the main track, couldn't park on the siding. He had to park on a hill on a slope because he couldn't block the roads. There's all kinds of factors. In fact, the deck was stacked so much against him, so heavily against him, that this was inevitable. It was going to be a catastrophe. Anyway, he left the train. Shortly after he left, there was a fire on that lead locomotive. The firefighters came, put out the fire. In putting out the fire, they turned off the locomotive, which disabled its air brake. The combination of the air brakes leaking out, he was not allowed to set the air brakes on the cars, and the handbrakes, the train started to move about an hour after, so about 1 o'clock in the morning. And about 15 minutes later, it derailed in the center of this little town, 6,000 people, sharp curve. It was driverless, going at 60 miles an hour, and it just burned and exploded. And if fire lasted for days, 47 people were killed. An unprecedented amount of volatile toxic oil was spilled. And this town center was just incinerated. So that's kind of the basic elements of the story.
Indeed. Could you share with our listeners why you wrote the book, Bruce?
I was actually on holidays, not that far away, maybe 3 or 4 hours away. Watched it on TV and saw the images on YouTube, and I thought, this can't be happening. As I watched, I was on holidays, but my background is policy analysis, and I'd done a lot of work on deregulation. And I thought, as I heard, the blame game going on, and they were kind of blaming the last link in the chain mostly, who was locomotive engineer, and I said, this is not right. I can write something independent which can unveil some of the truth behind what happened. And that's what I started doing. And I got back to my office at the end of the summer and learned that my work colleague had lost 3 members of her family. So this obviously put a whole new dimension on it. And I started writing reports. I wrote 3 reports, spent a year on a fellowship at a law faculty at the University of Ottawa here, and then I was approached by the publisher to write the book. So what you have is the culmination of that.
Yeah. Typically, these slash-and-burn sort of management policies are so typical of the neoliberal world we live in, where deregulations are trashed and corporations operate in reckless manners. And it seems like there were just so many, from my perspective, entities that shared the blame, yet the guys at the very bottom, the engineer and the dispatcher, caught what we may call the prosecution and such. I mean, it's It's the same story told over and over again in different industries.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story of, you know, regulatory failure and corporate negligence. I mean, it was a story of corporate criminality, and I've tracked over years this erosion of safety protections as the companies gain more and more power to self-regulate. And with austerity, together with austerity, it kind of undermined the regulator. It was under-resourced. It became dysfunctional. It's handed off more powers to the company. And all of this set the stage for a greater and greater probability of something really, really a major accident. And then there was the oil by rail boom. And it was really reaching its peak, both in the United States and in Canada. It was coming from Bakken. It was coming from Alberta, from the tar sands. Once that happened, and once, you know, this delinquent railroad had got permission to run its trains with a single operator, it was just that was kind of the tipping point of all of this. And I actually noticed, and I've been looking at some of the comparisons with the recent Boeing 737 MAX 8 crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia, and there's a similar, kind of a depressingly similar trajectory of the removal of protections and the outsourcing of regulations to the companies. In this case, Boeing was given the power to self-certify. It was kind of handed over, and the FAA kind of acquiesced to it on the grounds that, well, you know, it was being squeezed for resources, and so they got the power to do that. And they certified this faulty software system, and that's been implicated in both crashes.
Yeah, your book, New Term to Me, spoke of regulatory capture, and I don't know, you may have not coined it. First I've heard it, and certainly very apropos to how our industry and its watchers tend to collude to change the rules in a way to literally deregulate the industry and betray the interests of the public. Could you comment on that, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, the regulatory capture is central. It's where the regulatory capture and self-regulation, where the company gets to self-regulate, it's a kind of an oxymoron. It's the role. The primary motivation for the company is cost. It's profit. That's its mandate. It's the mandate of the regulator to ensure the safety of the public. First and foremost, that's its mandate, and it's not. It should not be handing over to the company the power to subordinate safety when it conflicts with economic considerations. And that's what was happening. And we saw in the year leading up to the Lac-Mégantic disaster, I mean, the companies were saying, oh, no problem, you know, there's a growing danger, but no problem, there's enough regulations, you don't need to do any more. And of course, this is a very conservative government in place, and it had imposed a one-for-one rule, which is if an agency like the transport agency were to propose a rule to cope with that danger, it had to remove another rule. This is kind of a Hobbesian choice, and it really led to a situation of, especially since it didn't have the resources, and so nothing was done. And then after it, after it, you know, there was a big flurry of activity to kind of convince the public that it was doing what was necessary to ensure safety. But the companies were in there too, doing what they could to block, dilute, delay, reverse any regulations that were in the works to being implemented. So very, very powerful companies, and the consequence is that those safety gaps have not been closed. They're still in place, and that's why my conclusion is that the window is still open for history to repeat itself.
Yeah, your last chapter of your book, I don't speak French, but it was clear to me, plus c'est charge. The more things change, the more they remain the same, Bruce. And a disaster like this certainly didn't really make a lot of difference in how the railroad is run. I know Central in this argument has been the one-man trains, and we've debated that here in America. Certainly, it's an ongoing debate, but still not resolved. Could you tell us why?
Well, I can tell you that within days of it happening, there was an emergency directive prohibiting single-person trains. And that actually is still in place. I think, they knew they were culpable, and they prohibited it. And I think because of the profile, it hasn't been. Although there's been pressure sort of behind the scenes, and as you say, there's a big push to federally to legitimize single-person trains, and I think in some states it actually is possible. But that's a big issue. There are a number of big issues in Canada. Generally, the railways are pretty well integrated. The companies, the lobbying, and the harmonization of regulations. There are some differences, but especially under NAFTA, they have all kinds of vehicles in which they get together with the government regulators and kind of agree on common regulations. But my concern is it works towards the lowest common denominator, not the highest common denominator. And so I think there's always a threat in Canada that they'll go back to single-person trains. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., that some of the regulations that were underway, I mean, I think there's a big problem both in Canada and in the U.S. with just the lack of oversight, actual inspectors that are on the ground doing on-site, unannounced inspections. And so, again, you've got these longer and longer trains that are heavier and putting all kinds of stress on the tracks. And we've seen derailments lately that are clearly the result of deteriorating track. And you still have problems with these volatile oil and other flammable liquids that are being carried in containers in cars that are not totally safe. They're not double hulled. Mm-hmm. There are examples of spilling and so forth. So
indeed,
as I said, there are in both countries, these enduring kind of safety gaps that haven't been closed.
Yeah. I worked in the trucking industry for a number of years, and what we see here in America is increased loads and decreased maintenance of road and bridge and constantly putting more and more of a strain on the existing infrastructure. In 2008, Bruce, I've read that the U.S. Congress passed legislation to support a positive train control, yet we still don't have it. They mandated it be in line by 2015, and here in 2019 we're still waiting. How do these things happen?
Yeah, and if you think it's bad in the U.S., it's worse in Canada in terms of implementing a positive train control, which is kind of a satellite-based remote control system that will monitor unwanted movement and stop unwanted movement. And you're right, that keeps getting pushed back and pushed back. And it's the same with these new braking systems, the electronic pneumatic brakes, which was also mandated in the U.S. In Canada, they're farther behind in that respect. So these problems get it's that part of the delay and dilute and block, which we've seen lots of examples of.
Everywhere we look, Bruce. Now charges were brought against the guys at the bottom of the totem pole there. But recently I read that the engineer and his dispatcher were exonerated. Terrible thing to take our the engineer through. How was that resolved?
Well, there was as so often happens, the tendency is to blame the last link of the chain. In fact, there were three frontline workers that were charged criminally. There was a lengthy trial, and the men were acquitted. And so you have a situation now. There's been no public inquiry, no judicial inquiry. So no one's been held accountable, no decision makers. Those three men were charged, but no one who, no executive of the company, the owner, Ed Burkhart, the key people within the industry who pushed for this, within the railway industry, or within the government, within the regulator, for example. No one has been held accountable. And so my friends, the people that I've developed close relationships with in Lac Megantic, are pushing hard once that not guilty verdict was announced, and you have this situation. They're pushing hard for a public inquiry because there are the unanswered questions. I think in terms of justice for the town, they need to know why it happened and who should be held accountable. Mm-hmm. And it's a vehicle to, for understanding as well when you have that kind of an inquiry, because there's clearly needs to be reform in the way, in the relationship between the industry and companies. And we can talk about the airline industry and the rail industry, but it's more broad. And I think one of the, there are obviously things that can be done to enhance public safety, but for me, the most important thing is that they need to be independent. They need to be well resourced, free of internal conflicts of interest, and protected from industry and political pressure to subvert the public interest. And this is the primary, as I said, the primary obligation of government to its citizens.
Bruce, we've quickly reached the end of our time allotment, so I want to thank you for appearing on the Heartland Labor Forum and sharing your book with us.
Support for KKFI is provided by Cross Currents Culture Unlimited, presenting multi-instrumentalist John McCutcheon in concert on Friday, April the 12th at 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 45th and Walnut in Kansas City. That's John McCutcheon, April the 12th, 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Church. Tickets and information at crosscurrentsculture.org.
The 2019 Spring KKFI Band Auction is coming on April 5th, 6th, and 7th, thanks to our sponsors, Stockyards Brewing Company. This is your chance to support community radio and have a great band or solo artist perform at your event. Here's how it works. Bands perform live or play recordings for 30 minutes on KKFI. You call in and place your bid on the artists. You win a two-hour performance sometime in the next year. KKFI connects you with the artists, and you work at a schedule that makes sense for everyone. Bands entertain you and yours, and then you smile yourself to sleep. It's just that easy. Artist lists and pre-bidding information at kkfi.org/bandauction.
In commemoration of the 51st anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, we present a rare speech of Dr. King's entitled America's Chief Moral Dilemma, recorded in May of 1967 on the Thursday night special at 7.
KKFI is proud to offer you, our listeners, access to the 2019 KKFI Collaborations Live event, Saturday, June 29th at 8 p.m. 10 unique collaborations will be brought to you on the historic Folly Theater stage. VIP options are available, but tickets begin as low as $10 to support your community radio station and have a wonderful night of music and dance. And tickets are on sale to the public this Friday at 10 a.m., but you get access right now for being a KKFI listener. Follytheater.org is where to use your pre-sale code of KKFI901FM. That's KKFI901FM to access the tickets before anyone else. Reserve your seat today for KKFI Collaborations Live at the Folly Theater. Follytheater.org, and again, that pre-sale code is KKFI901FM. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Tom Gepkin. I am a member of Communication Workers of America 6360, and the Republican supermajority in the Missouri legislature for years has waged a relentless war on labor in the state. Attacks on hardworking employees in the public unions like teachers, state workers, city and county employees with the implementation of House Bill 43. An assault on the construction trades with bills modifying and attempts to repeal prevailing wages. Right to Work was the centerpiece legislation of the Greitens' disgraced governorship. A vote of the people repealed this bad law in 2018, only to see it reappear in multiple forms in the 2019 session. The labor movement has always worked to improve the lives and conditions of working people. Discussions with those who write legislation is a very effective way to influence whether laws and regulations advance out of committee or die. Many states have a caucus representing labor in their state's Democratic Party. States like Indiana, Utah, Texas, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and California, to name a few. A labor caucus assists in coordinating many allies into a single voice. This provides union members with strength and the ability to influence the priorities and platform of a Democratic Party. Missouri does not currently have a labor caucus and is in the process of starting a statewide Democratic Party labor caucus. Labor contributes a lot of resources to those who seek office. This new Democratic labor caucus will give labor a voice and a seat at the table when it comes to issues concerning labor inside the Democratic Party. On the show tonight is the acting chair of the Democratic Caucus, Kevin Rusnick. He's a member of Operating Engineers Local 101 and vice chairman of the Democratic Committee for Cass County. He is also the state party delegate for the 31st District. Thanks for finding the time in your busy schedule to come and talk. Could you tell us how long you've been with 101 and who do they represent?
Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been with Operating Engineers Local 101 since 1995, and I've been a business representative for them since 2009. I've also been a member of Operating Engineers for 35 years, since 1984.
Yeah. How long have you been a committeeman, and why did you decide to become a committeeman?
I became a committeeman when we started doing our Right to Work petition drive and gathering signatures, and Cass County was not well represented in that area to have people collecting signatures in the rural part of the metro area.
Concerning the labor caucus and the development of it, could you start with telling us how this all came about and how the ideas and what are the goals of this caucus?
In January, we had our first state party meeting, and our new our new chair, Gene Peters Baker, was elected and became our party chair. And she had the idea to create the Labor Caucus. And from that, we branched out and had our first meeting. And I was elected the acting chair to start developing a caucus for the statewide. And some of the goals of our caucus are to encourage working men and women to participate in the political process and become aware of labor issues that affect today's working class people.
We almost need a labor caucus because labor is under constant attack, and we need a voice. We need a voice inside the party, and we need a voice inside the state. Where will the authority of this caucus derive from? Will it be with the party? Will it be the big donors or large labor unions? Where will the authority come from?
The authority comes from the state party chair, but I believe the caucus would speak for labor and influence the party and the direction that the caucus decides to take it. There's a committee yet to be formed to develop bylaws for the caucus, and that's going to dictate who is eligible to be part of the labor caucus.
Will the new caucus be able to influence a future Democratic governor on labor issues?
You would think if we ever had a Democratic governor that certainly labor would be a big factor in his decisions within the political process.
Now, the labor caucus structure was probably not defined yet because the bylaws have not been established, but do you have any ideas of how you'd like that to be?
Certainly, we want to establish a platform and a structure, and we'll have a chair, vice chair, secretary, treasurer to lead the caucus. And it's my idea that anybody who's affiliated in any shape or form with labor, whether they be union or non-union, should have a speaking voice within the caucus and be able to voice their opinion.
In my opening, I talked about all the states that have labor caucuses. Some of them are solid red states. How was Missouri able to repeal right to work without the influence of a labor caucus?
Without having a labor caucus within the state party didn't really have any effect, because labor folks and working class Missouri citizens came out in force and recognized that right to work was wrong for Missouri. And so they were all able to work together and gather signatures and talk to their neighbors, their friends, their relatives, their families, to convince statewide that right to work was wrong for Missouri.
If they would have had a labor caucus, would that have made the job easier?
Certainly it would have made it easier. We could have done a lot more. I think we could have got our message out a little bit more, and maybe even had a higher percentage of a vote to overturn right to work.
It was still a big accomplishment. Will the caucus set an agenda at the beginning of each legislative term? Is that the intent?
Certainly that would be part of what we develop within our bylaws, to have legislative items that we would focus our attention on within the state party and within Jeff City, and what legislation that we would be for or against.
What influence will the caucus have to get the party to adopt the agendas you guys present forward?
A platform needs to be developed within the caucus. The state party has a platform now, but I think it's important that the labor caucus review and approve that platform for the state party to move forward.
And it'll be labor issues. Will it be anything outside of labor that is brought forward?
I think labor really needs to focus on labor issues that are important for labor. The other caucuses have their agenda, and I think labor needs to stick to its own.
Now, some of the items that are important to labor are also important to the non-labor folks. Will you consider anything moving forward with the non-labor people, the people who are not in unions, the working people?
When I think of the labor caucus, I think of working families. So certainly we want to have a voice from all different backgrounds, and whether they're union or non-union, I want people to have a voice within the labor caucus.
The goal is to improve the lives of working people, and many of those people are not in unions.
Correct. We want to improve lives of Missouri citizens, whether they're union or non-union. This is all about labor and working families.
You have metropolitan unions, but we also have plenty of rural Missouri and suburban Missouri. How do you plan to reach those people?
We're going to focus on a statewide effort and getting our message out to all corners of the state. So far, I've been around to the Kansas City metro area. I've been up to St. Joseph, Missouri. Next week, I'm going to be heading out to Sedalia to be able to spread our message that way.
And we are talking with Kevin Rusnick. He's a Cass County committeeman, and he is a member of Operating Engineers Local 101. He's the vice chairman of the Democratic Committee for Cass County, and he's also the state party delegate for the 31st District. And you're kind of the driver of this. How did you get to be the driver?
We had our first state party meeting, and the labor caucus was developed, and we had our first meeting in January. So we were all meeting and talking about the direction of the labor caucus, and the participants that we had in attendance at that meeting nominated me to be the acting chair. So I've just kind of picked up the reins and ran with it, and certainly looking for a lot more participation from around the state to be part of our labor caucus that we're building for the betterment of labor, non-union, union, wherever they may be. We just want to lift up working families and wages and other issues that affect working families within a labor coalition. We want to build that.
Working people need a break. They've been kind of stepped on in the state of Missouri for a while. For this new labor caucus that's being formed inside the Democratic Committee, the Democratic Party, what are the requirements for joining this labor caucus?
As of right now, we haven't set any requirements. That'll be dictated by the bylaws that we adopt and write. It's my intent to bring anybody in that any shape or form working in labor, whether they be union or non-union. I want them to have a seat at the table and be able to vote on the issues that are important to the labor caucus to be able to present to the Democratic Party.
Do you have a real plan to reach the people out in the rural and suburban Missouri?
Certainly, I've been going around to different counties and participating in their fundraising efforts. Next week, I'll be going out to Sedalia at their annual Kirkpatrick dinner. And so I'll be meeting with the labor folks that are being in attendance at that function. And we'll be reaching out to those areas in the middle of our state.
How can people find out about you? Do you have a website that people can go look at?
I do have a Facebook page that we've created. It's Missouri Democratic Party Labor Caucus. And within some of the posts we have, there's a link that you can sign up for to be on our email list.
Okay. What are the requirements for joining the Labor Caucus, or have I already asked that?
At this point in time, we don't have any requirements, but that'll be written into our bylaws, and we'll be following up with those. We should have those adopted by our third quarterly meeting. Our next meeting for the state party is April 27th, so that's when we're going to set our bylaws committee up, and we'll be presenting them at our next quarterly meeting. But we'll need to set up a committee to review and write bylaws for the Labor Caucus.
Some of the things that are important to a whole bunch of people are family leave, parental time off when you have a child. Is Labor Caucus going to work towards that at all?
Certainly within union contracts, they dictate some of those benefits that other people aren't eligible for. So I think it would be important for the Labor Caucus to write into their platform additional benefits that are beneficial to working class people around the state. For example, family medical leave, where a mother and or a father or a significant other can have time off away from work and at the birth of their child. It's important to have that time off where they have that bonding. And typically throughout the state, people don't have that benefit available to them at this time.
We'd like that to be paid, right?
We'd like that to be paid, yes. I think there's an effort at the federal level to bring that benefit available to people.
One item that's important to every Missourian, as well as labor folks, is Medicaid expansion. Is that something that the Labor Caucus would want to get involved in?
I think that's another benefit that's available to labor folks, but not so much to people who are non-union. We didn't put that one out right.
Kevin, what are some other items that are important to this new Labor Caucus as it's being formed?
I think we have quite a few ideas that we'd like to see in our platform. Certainly, we'd want to see zero tolerance towards sexual harassment in the workplace. We want to see raising wages for Missouri citizens. We had an effort to raise minimum wage to $15, and now legislation in Jeff City is attacking that. We want to ensure that there's equal compensation for injured workers. We want to see a prevailing wage that's fair for public works projects around the state.
All items that the Republican Party controlling everything is attacking Missouri working people on.
Right. We want to make sure that labor folks around the state are aware of the issues that affect working families and how Jeff City is attacking those values and attacking labor and working families.
Pocketbook issues.
Right.
We're talking with Kevin Rusnick. He's the chair of the Cass County Democratic Committee. He's a business rep for Operating Engineers 101. And we're talking with him about establishing the Missouri Democratic Party Labor Caucus. Thanks for coming on the show and educating us about these important issues.
Thanks for having me today.
As this Labor Caucus is getting off the ground, what kind of people are you looking to participate in the Labor Caucus?
We're going to be looking for everybody who would like to participate, men, women, minorities, certainly anybody who feels that they're a labor person, anybody who's blue collar, works every day, works for an hourly wage. We want them to be and feel like they can be part of the Labor Caucus in the state of Missouri.
Everyone has a vested interest. That's a working person with paycheck issues.
That's right. And so we want to bring that to citizens of Missouri, where they have a place to go where they can feel like they can get their message and their agenda to our state party leaders and have a voice when it comes to the Democratic Party in Missouri and what happens at the state, local, and federal level.
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, researchers explore link between metal exposure and Parkinson's symptoms. From www.news.iastate.edu/news for March 12th. A new study from Iowa State University biomedical researchers illuminates the processes by which exposures to some metals can contribute to the onset of Parkinson-like symptoms. The study, published on March 12, focuses on the metal manganese, which has a range of industrial uses as an alloy. In Amantha Kanthasamy, professor in veterinary medicine and endowed chair of neurotoxicology, said the research details how manganese exposure can lead to misfolded proteins in the brain, which cause a neurological disease. Kanthasamy said the findings could lead to earlier detection of the disease and better outcomes for patients. Kanthasamy said small amounts of manganese are necessary for proper functioning of the human body, but too much exposure has been linked with neurological symptoms, much like those experienced by patients with Parkinson's disease. Links between manganese and neurological disorders have been noted since the 1950s because of the tendency of manganese to accumulate in brain tissues. The study found welders exposed to manganese had increased misfolded serum content, meaning the welders are at higher risk for developing Parkinson's symptoms, Kanthasamy said. Research could contribute to a new medical test to detect presence of misfolded proteins. This could lead to earlier detection of Parkinson's disease and a way to gauge the effectiveness of drugs designed to slow the disease. Next, search for solutions to invisible threat that affects cancer care workers from the University of Michigan at ihpi.umich.edu/news for March 1st. Exposure to chemotherapy can create hazards for nurses and pharmacists as they deliver life-saving care to patients, but use of protective devices remains low. Chemotherapy drugs are life-saving to cancer patients, but these toxic drugs are hazardous to healthcare workers who come into contact. Despite the risk, many healthcare workers do not use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves or gowns, when handling chemotherapy. A study from the University of Michigan Rogel Cancer Center sought to improve nurse handling of chemotherapy by delivering an educational intervention with quarterly reminders and tailored messages. But despite the strong study design and quality intervention, it did not increase use of protective gear. We really didn't move the needle at all. As a practicing nurse, it's disappointing. We're hoping that we could develop a bundled intervention that cancer centers and others could use, said Lee's study author Christopher R. Fries, professor of nursing and health management and policy at the University of Michigan. Exposure to chemotherapy occurs when healthcare workers inhale vapors or touch contaminated surfaces. Studies have found nurses who report handling hazardous drugs had twice the risk of reproductive problems. Other studies report incidents of rare cancer and various respiratory and skin condition. This is an invisible threat, Freeze said, as unlike needle stick where you know you've been stuck by a needle. With chemotherapy exposure, we don't have that smoking gun. This is a subtle threat, but it's a daily threat. Finally, majority of mine-related injuries and illnesses in Illinois go unreported. From today.uic.edu for March 9th. Illnesses and injuries associated with working in Illinois mines are substantially underreported, according to a new study published in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine. Mining remains hazardous and is associated with increased risk for injury, as well as several health conditions, including emphysema and black lung disease. Operators of coal, metal, and non-metal mines are required to notify the Mine Safety and Health Administration of occupational accidents, injury, or illnesses for their employees per the Part 50 program. The program provides the agency the authority to investigate. However, underreporting is a common occurrence. Researchers led by Dr. Robert Cohen, clinical professor of environmental and occupational health sciences at University of Illinois, at Chicago School of Public Health looked at Part 50 reports of injury and illness in Illinois from 2001 to 2013 and attempted to link each report to a corresponding Illinois workers' compensation case. The researchers found the Part 50 programs did not capture about 66% of Illinois workers' compensation cases among mining employees from 2001 to 2013. Underreporting to the Part 50 program really hinders the Mine Safety and Health Administration's ability to enforce safety and health standards, Cohen said. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for April 4th, 2019. The tenant organization that's been forming is meeting every week, Saturdays at 3 p.m. at 4526 Paseo in KCMO. Friday, April 5th at 11:30 a.m., Empower Missouri Friday Forum is going to be presenting Energy Efficiency as Social Justice, and that's going to be at the KCMO Central Library Vault Room. Sunday, April 6th, from 2 to 4 p.m. is Bruce Campbell, whom we just heard tonight, on the Lac Megantic rail disaster. It's going to be at Prospero's Books at 1800 West 39th Street in KCMO. Saturday, April 13th at 6 is the Cross Border Network Tamale Dinner with the band Cubanisms at St. Paul's Episcopal Church at 11 East 40th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. And for reservations, you can find them at crossbordernetwork.org. Friday, April 26th from 11:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. is the Gerald Randall Memorial Luncheon, this year honoring Bill Richardson at the Argosy Casino. You can get your tickets by April 1st. For information on ticket prices, email hrjrd@gmail.com. And lastly, the UAW Local 31 4th Annual Classic Car Cruise will be Saturday, June 8th from 1 to 5 p.m. at 500 Kindleberger Road in KCK. And all proceeds go to veterans. And also, last but not least, the KCMO Fire Department is hiring. You must be between 19 and 30 years old and a resident of KCMO. You can subscribe to the Greater Kansas City Activist Calendar by emailing gkcactivistcalendar@gmail.com. And you can find all of these, as well as our other shows, on the web at heartlandlaborforum.org. All right. That is it for this week's show. Next week is Feel the Trickle, the Tax Cuts, and cuts are in quotes. I've been your engineer and host tonight, Jen Zaman, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special. Judy will be back next week.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Struggle and fight for the common.